Thanks to donors like you, Aquinas 101 is setting the world aflame with the truth, but the next season can't be filmed without your help. Dozens of new episodes are planned, but they'll only be brought to life if you make them possible. Your gift by October 31st will bring the truth to students, families, and people around the world. Please use the link in the episode description below to give today.
Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at ThomisticInstitute.org.
My topic is beauty and its relationship to nature. Must all beautiful things, to the extent that they're beautiful, be natural? Like all of our topics, I think this weekend we could spend many days thinking about this topic and the issues in connection with it. Think of what I'm going to say here as a kind of orientation, and I hope provocation, giving you some resources for continued reflection on Thomistic aesthetics and on the place of beauty in human life. There's three parts to what I have to say. First, I'll give you a sense of the roots in St. Thomas for something we might call Thomistic aesthetics. Second, I'll explore an important 20th century debate between Jacques Maritain and Étienne Gilson about Thomistic aesthetics, and in particular about the relationship between nature and art. And finally, I'll offer you two examples of applications for us that are possible in 21st century, one drawn from the architectural theorist Christopher Alexander, and the other from the writer J.R.R. Tolkien. I think, now Father Ambrose can correct me, I gave all of you who are registered an excerpt from Alexander that I think is about 100 pages long, for which I do not apologize. You should read it, if not for today, then sometime soon in the future. And I'd like to know if that was the longest excerpt ever given to conference participants. We can talk about that later. Father Ambrose. Okay, so to begin, the first thing that must be said about Aquinas on beauty is that Aquinas didn't say much about beauty. Famously, when Jacques Maritain, I think the most important Thomist of the early 20th century, wrote Art and Scholasticism in 1920, he began by saying that, well, the Scholastics did not address beauty and artistic creativity head on, and that he'd be forced to draw on fragmentary and suggestive passages on topics like, is logic a liberal art? I think that was mentioned yesterday, as I recall. This is particularly true of St. Thomas, who gives us scattered, sometimes widely scattered, comments on beauty and art across his works. This afternoon, I'm just going to discuss two passages, since they're crucial, I think, for understanding St. Thomas on beauty, and have been very influential over the years. So first, when discussing God's goodness in question 5 of the first part of the Summa Theologiae, Aquinas has this to say in reply to an objection. And I'm going to read this slowly. It's a little long, and I hope it can be read towards the back, but I'm going to read it slowly and then say a few things about this. Beauty and goodness in a thing are identical, fundamentally, for they're based upon the same thing, namely the form. And consequently, goodness is praise as beauty. But they differ logically, for goodness properly relates to the appetite, goodness being what all things desire. And therefore, it has the aspect of an end, the appetite being a kind of movement towards a thing. On the other hand, beauty relates to the cognitive faculty, for beautiful things are those which please when seen. Hence, beauty consists in due proportion, for the senses delight in things duly proportioned, as in what is after their own kind, because even sense is a sort of reason, just as is every cognitive faculty. Now, since knowledge is by assimilation, and similarity relates to form, beauty properly belongs to the nature of a formal cause. This passage, some of you might know, was fundamental to Maritain's argument that beauty is a transcendental. One of the metaphysical modes of being that represent ways of considering all things insofar as they exist. This means, for example, that God, who is existence itself, would also be beauty itself. Individual creatures would be beautiful likewise to the extent that they exist, including perhaps unlikely candidates for aesthetic appreciation, rats, slime, Satan. Most Thomists, I think, over the last 100 years have agreed with Maritain that beauty is a transcendental, but there are some important objections. So we can talk later, Father John. St. Thomas himself never names it among the transcendentals. He names six: being, thing, one, something, truth, and goodness. I think it's still relevant, actually, to contemporary debate is Jan Eriksson's 1991 essay on beauty in the Middle Ages. He argues there quite vociferously that there are compelling reasons for saying that beauty is actually better understood as an aspect of goodness rather than an aspect of being as such. But whether or not beauty is strictly speaking a transcendental, it's clear enough, I think, that according to St. Thomas, and Jan Eriksson for that matter, all things that exist are beautiful to the extent that they exist, however we might understand the metaphysics involved. This has, I think, significant implications for what determines whether or not, and to what extent, something's beautiful, and how we might relate what is beautiful to what is natural. According to St. Thomas, a thing's existence can be measured after a fashion, and I think the word measured is a misnomer, but it's difficult to know what else to say, can be measured after a fashion in two ways. First, something exists more, shall we say, insofar as that thing expresses a higher or more perfect form of existing. So, for example, a perfect specimen of Arion hortensis, that's the garden slug, it's sitting there on a branch, for those of you in the back. A garden slug, Arion hortensis, possesses less being than a perfect specimen of Homo sapiens. There he is, walking on air, as we usually do. In other words, those things higher up the ladder of being possess a greater degree of existence than those lower down. Since all things are beautiful insofar as they exist, a perfect human being is more beautiful than a perfect garden slug. Now, I was traveling actually from another TI event and missed Father Raymond's presentation on the scale of essay. I'm going to assume this is actually repeating some of what he talked through and take as license his own reminder that we're in a series of liturgical repetitions this weekend. Something can also exist more by exemplifying in a more perfect way the particular form that one possesses. So a mature garden slug, here he is again, exists more than a baby one. It's hard to find a picture of a baby slug, by the way. And likewise, a healthy human exists more than a sick one. In other words, to the extent that you realize your own end or fulfillment as the kind of thing that you are, you also exist in a greater or fuller sense and are, to that extent, more beautiful. Now, this leaves some serious problems. This, by the way, is the ancient and universal symbol for philosophy. You might have noticed it's widely present in the titles of the talks this weekend. How do we compare, for example, the existence of a healthy garden slug with the existence of a seriously ill field mouse, a picture of which I couldn't find? But let's leave such things to one side for now. The important point is that if we say, with St. Thomas, that something is beautiful to the extent that it exists, and that something exists to the extent that it is higher on the ladder of being and more perfectly expresses the fullness of its own form, as the kind of thing that it is, then quite straightforwardly, something will be beautiful to the extent that it is natural. After all, one's nature is simply the particular way in which one exists, both as a particular kind of thing and as a more or less good exemplar of that kind of thing. So the healthier the garden slug is, the more natural it is, and likewise the more it exists, and so also the more beautiful it is. And since evil is always contrary to nature, as the absence of a do good, evil is always the loss of something that naturally speaking should be there. What is evil is likewise unnatural, and therefore also ugly. QED, as we say, beautiful things must be natural. To be honest, I do think this is what St. Thomas thought, and I also think it's metaphysically true. To the extent that something exists, it is more natural and therefore also more good and more beautiful. But as I said, this leaves a lot of room for questions, especially once we try to apply this abstract claim to our everyday experience. Well, is the healthy garden slug more beautiful than the sick mouse? How about more beautiful than a sick dog or a sick human being? Is a sick human being who's virtuous more beautiful than a healthy human being who's vicious? I could go on, but I'm not going to. Instead, let me change up a little bit the way I'm approaching the relationship between nature and beauty. In that passage from the Summa, there's first an identification of what's beautiful with what is good. And that's what we've been focused on for the last few minutes. But there's also a definition of beauty, that which, when seen, pleases. Connected to this is a first try at defining what counts as beautiful in a more particular way, that which is duly proportioned, since we delight in such things. Here's my second passage from the Summa that's also very well known and identifies in greater detail what makes something beautiful. Beauty includes three conditions: integrity, or perfection, since those things which are impaired are by that very fact ugly; due proportion, or harmony; and lastly, clarity, whence things are called beautiful which have a bright color. Beauty is that which, when seen, pleases, and therefore combines somehow knowledge and desire. Beautiful things, things that when we become aware of them fulfill in some sense our deep desires and so give rise to delight. Such things must be integrated, proportional, and clear or bright. Now, St. Thomas here combines two traditions of reflection on beauty. One tradition understood beauty as a result of something having all the parts that it should, and those parts being rightly related to one another. So part of my own beauty, such as it is a result of my having two arms attached exactly where they are, rather than where my legs are attached. I have no new slide for you for that image, and I resisted the temptation to use AI. Having the parts that you should and having them arranged as they should be is proportion or harmony. Related to this is integrity or perfection, which is the special kind of wholeness you have when you are an exemplary representation of your particular form. Even though, for interesting reasons, we often admire puppies and kittens more than dogs and cats, that would be worth thinking about, I think. A mature dog with all its parts in all the right places is more beautiful, more integrated, than a puppy with all its puppy parts in all the right puppy places. So both proportion and integrity concern the beauty something possesses as fulfilling, as best it can, the characteristics of its particular form or species. Think, for example, of the baby slug versus the mature one. The other tradition focuses on the power or brilliance or intensity of a particular thing that makes it beautiful. Rather than emphasizing the way a thing has what it should have in the places it should have it, clarity emphasizes the way a thing astonishes us with its radiance. This is not about parts and wholes, but instead about the brilliance or splendor of that which exists insofar as it exists. In this way, clarity explains why the healthy garden slug is less beautiful than the healthy human being. The form of the human being, his or her existence, radiates more powerfully, more brilliantly than the form of the slug. We can understand how important this feature of beauty is when we remember that God is beauty itself, and yet has no parts. His complete simplicity follows from the fact that he is existence itself, and so also the most radiantly beautiful, the most ravishing beauty among all that is. Now, so far I've been speaking about things as beautiful to the extent that they are natural, given that what is beautiful is in the deepest sense what exists. And so to exist more is to be more beautiful. But there's a different kind of question about the relationship between nature and beauty that is, I think, for many people, a more obvious question. When the artist makes something, is that thing beautiful to the extent that it is like the natural things in the world, and that the artist draws upon to make the work? Now, I'm very fond of this slide. As I look at it more and more, I think Rembrandt is saying, "What the hell are you doing, Picasso?" But I just want you to look at that face and think about that a little bit. These are both self-portraits. Picasso did many self-portraits. This is towards the end of his life. I think he's about 90 years old, and I don't think it appears the way it does because he's 90, but he made it at the end of his life. Rembrandt, too, that's later in his life, although he looks a little bit older than he actually is when he painted that. I think he's in his late 40s, perhaps. Now, let me turn to the second big section of my remarks today, the debate between Jacques Maritain and Etienne Gilson that played out through the A.W. Mellon lecture series at the National Gallery of Art in Washington, D.C. That series, endowed in 1948, hosted as the first of its lecturers Jacques Maritain in 1952. His lectures were published as Creative Intuition in Art and Poetry just a few years later. And they're widely recognized, I think, as Maritain's mature and definitive contribution to aesthetics. The fourth series of lectures were delivered in 1955 by Gilson and published as Painting and Reality just 2 years later. Likewise, I think, recognized as his mature and definitive contribution to aesthetics. Now, Maritain and Gilson, hopefully needing no introduction in this room, remarkable, profoundly influential Thomists of the 20th century, they agreed, of course, on a great deal. But Gilson's lectures were intended in part as a critique, even correction, of Maritain. Gilson insisted that Thomistic aesthetics should not be reduced to Maritain's aesthetics. Maritain emphasized the intellectual, even contemplative, activity of the artist. Every artist fashions with materials gleaned from previously existing reality. And Gilson instead emphasized the creative, even spontaneous, activity of the artist. The true artist makes rather than imitates, if not from nothing, then at least anew. Now, I'm talking about a debate that happened in the 1950s. I'm reading right now Dan McInerney's latest book on beauty as imitation, and it's quite good, quite interesting, and I think is clear evidence that this debate within the Thomistic tradition is still alive for us. Now, Maritain starts by with a definition of poetry, which he takes broadly. Here's what he says. Poetry is a special intercommunication between the inner being of things and the inner being of the human self, which is a kind of divination, as was realized in ancient times. This is the opening paragraph of Creative Intuition. The artist, I think Maritain wants to say, is blessed with a special insight into the inner life of things, and can incorporate that insight into visible, tangible, artistic form. But non-representational art, like Jackson Pollock's largely random, well, make that bold claim, drips of paint, or Pierre Mondrian's black lines and patches of color, sacrifice the deepest sources of poetic inspiration. Here's Maritain again. in breaking away from the existential world of nature, from things and the grasping of things, non-representative art, by this very fact, condemns itself to fall short of its dearest purposes and the very ends for the sake of which it came to life. Cut off from the mystery of integral reality, to be obscurely attained in some of its transparent aspects. That's a typical Maritain sentence there. In other words, cut off from poetic intuition, a certain kind of vision. Any effort to express freely the free creativity of the spirit and to reveal the depths of creativity is bound to slow extinction. Gilson's own lectures include an epigraph from Plotinus on their first page. Here's the epigraph. If one attempted to belittle the arts by saying that in creating they imitate nature, the answer should be that the arts create many things by themselves. Where something is lacking, they supply it because they own beauty. Now, Gilson insists that the artist's proper activity is necessarily non-representational. Here's Gilson. A true painter does not borrow his subject from reality. He does not even content himself with arranging the material provided by reality so as to make it acceptable to the eye. His starting point is fantasy, imagination, fiction, and all the elements of reality that do not agree with the creature imagined by the painter have to be ruthlessly eliminated. Even more, there's another passage from Gilson. Imitation, that is, representation of reality as it appears to be, stands on the side of science, or to use a more modest word, knowledge. Reduced to its simplest expression, the function of modern art has been to restore painting to its primitive and true function. Pollock and Mondrian are heroes in this story. Primitive and true function, which is to continue through man the creative activity of nature. Aristotle famously says, we are imitative creatures. Dan McInerney, for example, interprets that to mean that we imitate nature. Gilson takes that to mean that we imitate what nature does, which is to be creative. Maritain considers the artist in a profound way a kind of contemplative mystic, a seer, blessed with remarkable vision. And what is seen is taken up and transformed and incorporated into a work of art. But Gilson considers this no better than fancy language for art as imitation, the kind of work deplored by Socrates in the Republic. Instead, for Gilson, the artist is an inventor, a creator of new things. Now, this disagreement between Maritain and Gilson is in part a disagreement about the sources of artistic accomplishment. Maritain understands the artist as a powerful messenger, carrying to us from the deep places of the world things that we might otherwise never know, wrapped in the subjectivity of the artist. Without access to reality in this way, the artist's materials are impoverished. And so the art produced is likewise meager, even boring. Gilson, on the contrary, sees the artist as a creator of new things, never before seen or even conceived, who brings forth for our delight astonishing new beings from the internal spontaneity of the artist's own inner life. Maritain's vocabulary that he takes up into his title, the vocabulary of creative intuition, in other words, a seeing that provokes a creative response, is directly countered by Gilson's own vocabulary of creative imagination, sometimes creative perception or creative sensation, that is, non-knowing words, or a different kind of knowledge, at least. Maritain's tendency to characterize the initial creative moment as a contemplative vision, and so a confrontation between the artist and being, a kind of awareness, is contrasted in Gilson as he characterizes that initial creative moment as a motive force or tendency that is a moment of becoming rather than contemplation that's open to many, even perhaps infinite, possible actualizations. If we follow Maritain, it might seem that the culmination of our experience of a work of art is to move beyond the art itself, as necessary as that art, of course, might be, to the deep things that were themselves the inspiration for the artist. But for Gilson, aesthetic experience culminates in simple delight in the work itself, a kind of rest in the beautiful. As he says, to the extent that it succeeds in achieving its own mode of artistic existence, a painting is justified in being exactly what it actually is. I fear I'm going on a little long. What does this have to do with nature? Maritain and Gilson agree that no artist makes from nothing, ex nihilo. Again, connected, I think, to some things we were thinking about yesterday afternoon. But Maritain emphasizes the artist's dependence on previously existing natural forms, which provide the foundation of all art, whereas Gilson emphasizes the newness of what is made and the fact that the artist makes something never before seen, an unfolding of one of the as yet unrealized forms of being. If Maritain's right, then we should expect paintings, for example, to be more successful as paintings, to be therefore more beautiful, to the extent that they make use of forms pre-existing in nature, even if they're taken up and refashioned. But if Gilson is right, then what a painting is of, that is, what the subject of a painting is irrelevant to the beauty of the painting, as a painting. All that matters is the painting itself and the way that it combines its own internal elements into a unified whole. For Gilson, a completely abstract painting is in no way at a disadvantage, I think, when it comes to its intrinsic beauty in comparison to a painting of the Madonna or the Crucifixion. That is, for Maritain, man-made things are more beautiful to the extent that they somehow incorporate, reveal, show insight into those natural things that already exist. For Gilson, man-made things are more beautiful to the extent that they somehow realize never-before-seen possibilities of being itself. And the relationship of something made to something already existing is irrelevant with respect to its beauty. Now, these are heady waters. Forgive me, just after lunch and perhaps a nap for at least one or two of you. And I freely admit that I might be misinterpreting Maritain or Gilson or both. But the following seems true to me for Maritain. A painting of Christ has, at least prima facie, the opportunity for greater beauty than a painting of a garden slug, because Christ himself is more beautiful than a garden slug. But for Gilson, the fact that Christ and the garden slug are sitting for Picasso, unfortunately, and not Rembrandt, has absolutely no bearing on the intrinsic possibilities for beauty in either painting. What a painting is of just has nothing to do with whether or not a painting is beautiful. In both cases, there's a connection between beauty and nature. For Maritain, art sees into nature and carries to us some of its secrets. For Gilson, art, like nature, is creative and bodies forth newly existing things never before seen, save in the mind of God, as pure possibles. But here I leave off my second theme for today and turn to the final section of my remarks. Now, I wish to give you two recent examples of contemporary developments in our reflection on these things. As I said before, the architectural theorist Christopher Alexander and J.R.R. Tolkien. Now, first, Alexander, unlike Maritain and Gilson, I'm unsure how well-known Christopher Alexander would be to this room. May I ask how many of you have read something by Christopher Alexander before I sent you? Well, I don't want to ask about the 100 pages, but okay, two. I see two people. Yeah, that's a wonderfully high hand that you held up, Josh. I was glad to see that. Alexander is quite a remarkable person. British-American citizen, born in Austria in 1936, died just a few years ago in 2022 at the age of 85. He spent most of his career at Berkeley in California and was a practicing architect and general contractor, as well as an academic. Though his religious commitments have always seemed, at least to me, a little mysterious, he certainly believed in God. And I recommend to all of you a beautiful essay called Making the Garden, which appeared in First Things in 2016, in which he refers to himself as a practicing Catholic. He spent his career seeking a deeper understanding of living things. And though his language is different, as best I can tell, he agrees with Aquinas, Gelson, and Maritain that what has more being also has more goodness and life and ultimately beauty. In this sense, what is more natural in the deepest metaphysical sense is also more beautiful. As an architectural theorist, he wished to identify somehow what it was that made things beautiful without recurring to simple imitation of past architectural and artistic forms that were at their time very beautiful. So he does not, for example, want to recover Gothic architecture or classical architecture, but instead wants to identify what makes all architecture or all living things more generally fully alive and beautiful. Now, Alexander wrote many deeply influential things during his life. In that First Things article, he claims, I don't know if this is true, but he claims that a pattern language, which appeared in the 70s, is the best architectural seller ever, which could be true. He wrote an early book based on a mathematics dissertation that established a branch of computer science, pattern language in the 70s, which is a remarkable investigation of the various forms of order that we find in the built world. His magnum opus, The Nature of Order, was published in the early 2000s. The chapter I sent along is only one chapter from it, and The Nature of Order is four volumes, and that's only one chapter from one volume, and I promise it's worth it, and I encourage you to purchase all four if you ever win the lottery. The chapter I sent you is on 15 fundamental properties. Consider these properties a way of deepening and extending the three fundamental characteristics of beauty that Aquinas lays out: integrity, proportion, and clarity. In other words, I think Alexander gives us a way to think in greater detail than Aquinas did about the necessary natural features of beautiful things. These properties, we might say, are necessary features of the unfolding of existential possibilities. To the extent that something successfully instantiates a way of being, it will manifest these properties. Now, to my knowledge, no one working in Thomistic aesthetics has yet picked up on the possibilities here, and I think there's actually a great deal of work that can be done sort of thinking about the relationship between what he's doing and the Thomistic tradition. Here's a little taste of Alexander. I asked myself this question: can we find any structural features which tend to be present in the examples which have more life and tend to be missing in the ones which has less life? In other words, can we find any recurrent geometrical structural features whose presence in things correlates with their degree of life? To find this out, it's necessary to make thousands and thousands of comparisons, to ask oneself constantly whether any features can be identified which correlate with the degree of wholeness which things have. This is what I did. For 20 years, I'm still reading Alexander, in case you were wondering. For 20 years, I spent 2 or 3 hours a day looking at pairs of things: buildings, tiles, stones, windows, carpets, figures, carvings of flowers, paths, seats, furniture, streets, paintings, fountains, doorways, arches, friezes, comparing them and asking myself which one has more life, and then asking what are the common features of the examples that have most life. Now, here's all 15 properties, the result of his search, listed altogether too quickly. Levels of scale, strong centers, boundaries, alternating repetition, positive space, good shape, local symmetries, deep interlock and ambiguity, contrast, gradients, roughness, echoes, the void, simplicity and inner calm, and not separateness. These are the things for Alexander that determine whether or not something, in his words, has life, or in our words, has beauty. Now, I've been describing, and Alexander uses the language of geometrical structural features, and what I'm about to show you is a material version of this. But I think we could apply these same features to immaterial realities. So the 15 properties I just described to you, I think, apply in all kinds of interesting ways to the political structures that Professor Hochschild was describing before lunch. Here is an image from the passage I sent you all. I'm going to talk about one property in particular, good shape. This is Alexander's, one of his examples of good shape. It's a picture of the Honden or hall of the Shinto shrine Izumo Taisha, possibly the oldest Shinto shrine in Japan. The caption under it from Alexander is just, "This is a Japanese shrine. Its shape is so beautiful it requires no comment." Now, I think that's right, actually. And I'd be curious how you all react to this shape. I'm going to say a little bit about what he thinks makes a good shape, and I'll leave this up, and then I'm going to flip to a second slide in a moment. So here's Alexander. What is good shape? What is it made of? It's easiest to understand good shape as a recursive rule. The recursive rule says that the elements of any good shape are always good shapes themselves. Or we may say this once again in terms of centers. I'll say a little bit more about what a center is. A good shape is a center which is made up of powerful, intense centers which have good shape themselves. Now, Alexander uses the word center throughout this work. It's in some respects the core idea of his account of order, and so also of beauty. A center for him is an integrated whole that both contains additional centers within it and is itself part of larger wholes. It's both separate and connected to everything around it at smaller and larger scales. I think it makes sense, actually, from a Thomistic perspective, to call these centers forms or formal unities. You might try out substance or accidental natures, however you think about it, though the point is, the contrast is with formlessness and disorganization. Here's two examples from Alexander. And let me just talk through these a little bit. The image on the left is a, and I realize you all probably can't see, I can barely see, the words underneath those images. On the left you have a teapot stand. And on the right, I'm curious if anybody knows what that is. It's a chair. Yeah, it's a, the caption is, "Terrible shape in a futuristic chair." And then on the left, the beautiful shape of the teapot stand. Now, why does he think the one on the left is beautiful and the one on the right is not beautiful? The images on the bottom part of the screen show the formal portions of each object abstracted from the whole. And Alexander's claim is that the formal parts of the teapot stand are themselves unified and beautiful. Simple, to be sure, but nevertheless coherent as, say, integrated objects. His claim about the chair, and it's a little hard, these actually do match up with different portions. This is the seat, for example. This is the bottom portion. One of them is the arm. His claim is the abstracted portions of the chair are not themselves integrated unities. They are, in a certain respect, formless. This is what Alexander says in conclusion. Although it may seem surprising to someone raised in the mechanist functionalist tradition, good shape in buildings, rooms, gardens, streets plays a vital role in the way they work. Essentially, what happens is that the thing which works effectively must have more centers in it. That is, more smaller centers of unity. and by virtue of having more centers, has better shape. So the good shape is not only making things more beautiful, it also makes them work more profoundly, more effectively. In other words, the old supposed divide between what's functional and what is beautiful is actually a mistake. What's maximally functional is also maximally beautiful. Or to put it another way, what's beautiful is also what's good. Now, I dare say Tolkien needs no introduction to all of you. How many of you, though, have read Smith of Wootton Major? Four people, none of whom were the same as the first two people. I sent that one along, too, and it's much shorter. Smith of Wootton Major is Tolkien's last story. He wrote it in the 60s. He published it 6 years before his death. It's a rewriting of his own creative life. It's a fairy tale. I'm not going to retell it for you, although I'm going to retell portions of it. So, and then I'm going to talk about these images, and then I'll be done. The story goes like this. Once was a village, and in that village, it was the tradition every 24 years to make an enormous cake and serve it to 24 children. And the king of fairy is connected to the making of that cake, and sees to it that a star is swallowed by a young boy, the boy Smith. That star makes Smith into an artist. And as the possessor of the star, he becomes a maker of beautiful things, and he gets access to the fairy world. He's permitted to travel into fairy, the entrance to which is just outside of the town, and he spends long days, even we might say years, traveling in fairyland, and when he returns, time hasn't passed in the same way. So the first thing I want to say about this, Tolkien wrote an explanatory essay about it, which has only been recently available, and he says, fairyland was set up so that the person in fairyland could wander in fairy as long as he wished, and it would not disturb his normal life. He would come back and time would not have passed in the same way as it had in fairyland. Those of you who are familiar with Narnia, it's that kind of connection, that kind of experience of time. Now, what that does, of course, for Tolkien, if it's true, is that it makes fairyland safe. Because whatever you do in fairyland, it does not take away from your time and so also your opportunities to act in the real world. Now, in the actual story, this is false, even though Tolkien asserts it of the story. And I think one of the things this story does is it represents fairyland as a beautiful and dangerous place. And so, likewise, a place that in certain respects is contrary to nature. Now, why do I say that? The images that I gave you, by the way, the illustrator for this book is Pauline Baynes, who illustrated C.S. Lewis's stories. They're wonderful drawings, and there are even more of them in the actual book. I've given you three along the top. The one on the bottom is an enlargement of the top portion of the picture on the far right. Now, just to say a little bit about what these represent. The middle one I'll say least about. That's a picture of Smith being overwhelmed by some elven warriors who pass by him, really without any interest in him. So he's an explorer of fairyland, and he comes across many sights, adventures, dangers, beauties. And one of them is this image of these elven warriors marching past him. But I'm particularly interested in the image on the right and then the image on the left. The image on the right is a drawing of Smith dancing with the Queen of Fairy and all of her maidens. On one of his explorations, he discovers her. She doesn't tell him she's the Queen of Fairy. And they dance. And the enlargement at the bottom is their dance. It's still probably a little bit hard for you all to see at the back. The reason I care about it is because the image on the left is Smith coming home after that dance. And the Queen of Fairy gave Smith a flower. And the flower is still in his hair when he arrives home. and his shadow looms large against the wall, and his family's happy to have him back, and the flower becomes a kind of heirloom. But I just want you to, I mean, one could tell, this is not how Tolkien tells the story, but one could tell it like this. Well, my dear, I'm back. I went out and found a beautiful woman and danced with her and some other women for quite a while, and she gave me this flower. Isn't it beautiful? Now, Pauline draws this, it's a little hard for you to see it from there, but Pauline draws the image of his homecoming a little bit, there's some complications. Smith is not looking at his wife. His wife does not exactly have a happy face on. The story is very lighthearted, but there are some depths beneath it that are, I think, profound and in certain respects very challenging. Last thing I'll say about the story, Smith, when he gives up the star, and he does give it up eventually when he's about 60 years old, he comes home and it turns out that he met the fairy king, and as a result of giving up the star and his conversations, he missed his grandson's birthday. His son is at home and says, "You were expected." And Smith says, "Oh, I know, I was detained. Fairyland detained me." And he says, this is a beautiful line and a very difficult one. He says, "Surely once they know where I was, they will forgive me, comma, maybe." Then his son says to him, I think with evident relief, once his father tells him his journeys are done for good, he says, "Father, I'm so glad that you'll be home. You still have much to teach me that you haven't yet taught me before." Basically, he's been an absent father, more or less. Now, my conclusion here, and here's where I end, is just this. Alexander gives us a way of seeing the natural world as a more complicated foundation for all beautiful things in some very deep and provocative ways. Tolkien's story provokes us to ask, is it not the case that beauty is dangerous? I think it is rare for us to say that good things are dangerous, although sometimes we speak that way, but beauty is clearly dangerous. And to that extent, it challenges us to integrate the beautiful with the natural. If we think of Smith's home and his family and his responsibilities in the world as the world of the natural and of his natural obligations, then fairyland is a potential distraction and danger. Tolkien says, "Fairyland is neither the road to heaven nor to hell, though some people have thought it can end up there." Thank you very much.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith, and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.